Thank you, Steve. I'm hoping that Steve will allow me to moderate the secret debate we have scheduled between Donald Trump and DeGrasse Tyson on the theme, is the Earth really round? So I hope you'll come back for that. Anyway, it's an honor to be here, and I'm sure it vindicates all of you that have all these years have thought that indeed I must have a face made for radio. This is sort of a special occasion and sort of marks the culmination of one of the more satisfying and fun things I've done in my career, which is to work with this gentleman on my left, not necessarily politically, who's one of the most important political figures in Michigan history. Frank Kelly was... Frank Kelly served as Attorney General of this state for 37 years. Not only is that longer than anyone has ever served as Attorney General in Michigan, it's longer by far than anyone has ever served in this country. And there are several remarkable things about his tenure. He completely changed the nature of the office. It had been an office that it was a reactive office. If people sued the state, the Attorney General would do something. He turned it into... He established what was probably the first consumer protection division in the country. Environmental protection was a pioneer in women's law, women's rights, civil rights. One of his first big cases was a civil rights case. And he has a fascinating life. I've known Frank slightly for a long, long time, ever since he came to my dorm when I was in college and he was running for the U.S. Senate, the only race he ever lost in his life. And I think actually we and he are better off for it, but he'll tell you about that. And then I went to see him about 5 years ago. I like to pick his brains every so often. And I said, why don't you write your memoirs? And he said, well, he'd been working on it, but he really didn't know how to get it published or how to get it done. So we made a partnership, and it was not only a very satisfying experience, it was a lot of fun. He told me what Lewis Cass was like, what Stephen Stevenson's was like, and I'm going to turn you over to him. We're going to talk for a little while about the book, but we're very much interested in your questions. But by the way, I feel constrained to point out that even Frank left one term before he had to under term limits. You know, it's sort of like a long time ago, somebody told me you want to leave a party a little bit before they want you to leave rather than being thrown out in the street. And so this is the beginning of our reelection campaign. I have been, for Frank, I have been promised the position of Minister of Propaganda. And so, but at any rate, to be serious, not only has Frank become, I've done these kinds of things before, but not only has he become a close friend, he's one of the people I admire most in the world. Frank Kelly.
Yeah, thank you.
Tell us something.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jack. First of all, somebody 91 years old might run for Attorney General, but it won't be me. Jack, I wrote this book towards the end of my political career, because I felt two or three things. I felt that the reactionaries and the corporations and their propaganda mills, which work 24 hours a day, had convinced many Americans, probably too many Americans, maybe even a majority, that the government was really their enemy. The average citizen, the government is your enemy. And the fact that the only instrument you have to have any relief in a free society is through your government. You got to take over the government some way or another. Corporations aren't going to do it for you. You show me a charter of any corporation, and I'll show you the purpose of the corporation, and it's to make money. There's nothing in there about doing good for the public or helping humanity or giving to the Commonwealth. Nothing. Corporations, and not only that, but the average person doesn't know that corporations are created by the state. We gave them the right to do that in order to encourage economic development. But the thing that I want to hear from Jack is, because all of you are listening to him every day on public radio and so on, and his articles and different things, And I want him to tell me and tell you, why did he choose? He's got seven jobs. And I don't know how he keeps up with any of them, but I want him to tell me, please, in front of this audience, what motivated you to do all this communicating?
That's a fascinating question. I don't think we ever talked about that. And, well, the fact is that I had a really superior curveball and a fastball and a slider, but none of them went more than 15 feet. And I was on my path to become a historian. I realized that I was really a superficial dilettante. And I was interested in everything. And somebody told me, you know, you can find out interesting things about people and tell them about it and get paid for it. And I said, I'm there. But I think I've spent my life trying. What I like doing is helping people understand things, learn things, sort of explaining the world to them. And I've never been interested. My first image of journalism when I was young was the Three Stooges, you know, running around. There was an episode where they pulled the press buttons out of the wall, out of the, you know, bathroom sink faucet and put them in their hats. And people going up and saying to people whose babies had been run over by a truck, how do you feel? I didn't want to do that. But thanks to outlets like Michigan Radio, where we don't do that kind of news, we do the kind of journalism I've always dreamed of doing all my life. And Steve Schramm, our wonderful boss, makes it possible, along with all these other folks. So I'm just the piano player. But thank you, Frank. But people are far more interested in you than me. And I'm intrigued by the fact that what possessed you, as you said once, to make a career of the job? Every other attorney general, you know, prior to Frank, the longest serving attorney general in Michigan history had served 5 years. And that guy died before the Civil War, so I couldn't interview him about the book. What possessed you to revamp the office, to make a career of this?
Well, I can speak freely in an Irish pub because that allows me to exaggerate. But I came from my grandfather came from Ireland, County Mayo, God help us, which is the poorest county in Ireland. It's the most beautiful. Everybody takes pictures of it, but nobody eats there very rarely, you know, County Mayo. And that's where we were from. And my grandfather never wanted to go back to Ireland because the last thing he saw before he got on a boat was a mass grave with 300 people being buried at once. He didn't think there was anything wonderful about that country. He wanted to get out of there. And my father came from a family of 8 children, and they were never encouraged to go back to Ireland. I went back later on and enjoyed it immensely because I went back as an attorney general instead of an exploited citizen of Ireland. As a matter of fact, I went with Tip O'Neill, so you can imagine. you can imagine how we were treated. Tip O'Neill was standing me. We were in the Dáil, and because he was, you know, a speaker, and attorney general sounded good to the people in the Dáil. They're like any Irishman that comes over and makes a living, you know. So they suspended the Dáil, and we had a receiving line. And I'll never forget, Tip O'Neill was standing next to me, and he leans over to me and he says, "Isn't it great to be Irish?" And I said, "Look over your shoulder. You see that guy sweeping the street out there? That's what it means to be Irish. Just be thankful you're an Irish American and amounted to something. That's the only damn reason you're getting a review here, you know." And he said, "You know something? You're right, you know." And it's true, because the Irish have been exploited for so many years. But not every Irishman, even the ones in here, know that in the Irish culture, poetry, writing, and creative work have always been treasured. And they were particularly bitter about the fact that the British prohibited all that sort of thing. So not everybody knows that in Ireland, if you're a published poet, a published writer, or a published creative person, like a John Huston that directed all those movies and so on, he became a dual citizen. He lived in Ireland for 20 years. He made about $20 million. If you are any of those occupations in Ireland, you pay no income tax.
That's why you wanted to write the book.
No. No, but the point is that the Irish look up to you if you're right or a poet.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I don't want to insult any English descendants here because I'm long over the prejudice against the British, almost.
But, now, speaking of being Irish.
Yeah, but I just wanted this one quote. My dad even used this one. He said the Irish were writing poetry when the British were swinging in trees. I like that one. I never use that to get votes, I'll tell you that.
You were really, you know, it's when I got to know you, it struck me that how big a force your father was in your life.
Well, my father, my father was an unusually nice man, and I love my father very much. And, I've got a lot of, my father was the head of Eloise. Remember Eloise? That was the Wayne County, I'll tell you a little history there. Legislatures never change. They're cheap and selfish and uncompassionate. Detroit and Wayne County, obviously, as the population center of the state, had the most mental patients. The legislature would never build a mental hospital in southern Michigan. They hated Detroit just as much as they do now. Okay? And so, believe it or not, there was a mental hospital in Traverse City, Ionia, different places had mental hospital. Never built one in Detroit, which meant that if you were adjudicated mentally ill in Detroit, you had to go to the county. Every county had a poor farm. Wayne County had a poor farm, and they built some buildings out there, and they converted it into a county infirmary. And that was known as Eloise, or Wayne County General Hospital. All state mental patients from southern Michigan had to go to Eloise because there was no state mental institution. And my father was a county official. He was the chairman
Board
of Institutions for Eloise. And so I got compassion for mentally ill there. My dad got compassion for mentally ill, and he became addicted to public service. And like a lot of first-generation Irish, he never had the opportunity to get an education. His mother died of childbirth fever when she was 39. His father died of a crushed stomach in a foundry accident in a factory when he was 39 years old, so left 8 children. And so my father was not able to get an education beyond the 5th or 6th grade. But he always wanted his children to be educated, and I was the firstborn, so he used to use me as the sounding board, you know. And every idealistic idea he ever got, he'd tell me about it, you know. Expect me to live up to it.
And my favorite thing is what your father told you about public service. He said, Frank, if you want to encourage, he said, I encourage you to seek a career in public service if you're inclined to. But, however, remember, they stoned Moses, crucified Christ, and shot Lincoln. What do you think your chances are?
Yeah. In other words, my father was a very practical person.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, but anyway, he encouraged me to do that, and then I finally got through law school and became a lawyer, and my dad and I agreed that I wanted to be a trial lawyer. He wanted me to stay in Detroit and work in a Wayne County prosecutor's office. That's where all the trial lawyers came out of, most of them, or they went to a small town and had the older lawyers in these small towns beat up on them for 3 or 4 years. Then they learned to be a trial lawyer, and then they came back. So I wanted to go to a small town because I had a young family, and I didn't want to go into the Detroit Recorder's Court. It was kind of tough. So my dad wanted me to stay in Detroit, but we finally made a deal. I'll go out state, and I'll come back in 3 years. But once I made the decision to go, and my father blessed it, my father had a heart attack and passed away. And so I was left with a decision to go to Alpena, Michigan, which I went to. It's all in the book. That's interesting about going to Alpena. And I went up there to learn to be a trial lawyer. And can you imagine being in a small town? The first case I had was getting out of prison a criminal sexual psychopath. That was my first case. And you would figure I'd get run out of town on a rail. I got him out. And instead of being, you know, running mad, they said, that kid must be clever. I wasn't, but they thought I was. So anyway, then I got better. The second case was they wanted to build a jail. I don't know if you've ever been to Alpena, but the WPA built some beautiful courthouses during the Depression. They built a beautiful courthouse in Alpena. Well, they wanted to put a jail on the grounds with a courthouse in the center of town. And the people were up in arms, so they hired me to stop that. So I asked for a special meeting of the Board of Supervisors. I got 100 top people in town. And the upshot was that they moved the jail 3 miles out of town, and I became a hero. But all this was in the process of learning to be a trial lawyer. I used to go into court and get kicked around, and I'd make a motion, and the lawyer on the other side would make a motion about 5 miles long, throw me out of my ear, you know. after the case is over, I'd say, well, you tell me everything I did wrong. And then I read it all out. After about 3 years, I had a postgraduate course, and then I was given hell to everybody else. Then I was ready for other work. But that's why I was up in Alpena. But through my dad and through my compassion for the mentally ill, he felt that the only thing a lawyer should do is help his fellow man. And his favorite quote and my favorite quote was from Horace Mann. It said, be afraid to die unless you obtained a victory for humanity. If you haven't done that, your life isn't worth anything. So that was our motivation. And so I try to do that all my life. And
you know, Frank, you did something that when I was young, millions of women dreamed about doing. You spent time by yourself in a hotel room with John F. Kennedy.
Different action went on.
I imagine. But tell us about, you told me that, tell us about Kennedy.
Well, I met a lot of people. You know, because I had that long tenure, I'd be able to, the National Association of Attorneys General, I was president, and they would send me to Germany to meet the Attorney General in Germany. And so I'd meet the Attorney General of Israel, and I got to meet a lot of people because of my seniority. And I was known to the Kennedys. And as a matter of fact, in my book, the first chapter, is I was Attorney General about 2 weeks, and Bobby Kennedy summoned me to Washington, and we had a nice visit for about an hour and a half. And I got to know Bobby quite well. And what happened was, to show you that John F. Kennedy was a good person, 2 weeks before the election for John Swainson's reelection, when he was running against Romney, Phil Powers or somebody came into Kennedy's office. So we got the latest polls. That's young Swainson out of Michigan. He's going to lose the election. And you could go someplace else and campaign and do yourself some more good than to go there with Swainson. And John F. Kennedy said this right there, and I have witnesses of the conversation. He says, listen to me. John Swainson had both his legs blown off when he was 18 years old in France. He said he gave that to his country. He said, do you think I'm going to turn my back on him? We're going to Michigan. We're going to stay all day. And he came. And so they wanted, because he was an Irishman, they wanted me to campaign with him, so with the governor. So we met Kennedy at the airport, and I was with the first part of the trip, the half day, and he left about 2 o'clock that afternoon. But at noon, Swainson had the artificial legs, and he had a rest. So we get to the Sheraton Cadillac downtown about noon, and we go up into the presidential suite. They got a spread there, and for about a half hour, they let all the dignitaries come through and have their picture taken with President Kennedy. Then they shut the doors, and Swainson went into a room, took his legs off to take a nap, and that left Kennedy and I in front of this buffet. And so he had 2 Secret Service men there. He said to the one, go on the other room. And there was only one guy there. And so we start talking, and that's when I had a conversation. And I must tell you, I met a lot of people from popes to kings and everything else. Spent a whole day with Makarios and Cyprus, different people like that, Willy Brandt. But the most impressive person I ever met in my whole life was John F. Kennedy. I mean, he really had it. And he had an unusual lucky break. His back x-rays, he had a terrible back. And I've seen the x-rays in books that were published later. His back was barely connected. It's a wonder he could even walk, you know. But he had another additional benefit. He was one of those persons that did not feel pain. In other words, pain didn't bother him much. He had great resistance to pain. He had this terrible back, but the pain didn't reach him too much. So he could smile and be relatively pain-free, even though he had this agony, this terrible back. And so when I met him, I look at him, and we're sitting there at this buffet, and we start off, he's got a championship haircut. He's handsome. He's got a nice tan. He's got a beautiful, melodious voice between Harvard and Massachusetts. And he was smiling, and I could tell he enjoyed it being in his own skin. He knew he was a prince, and he enjoyed it. He was happy. He says, I like being Jack Kennedy. And so and he had tailor-made shirt, tailor-made tie, Savile roll suit, Spanish-made shoes. And, you know, I could spot those things because I always wanted them and never had them, you know. And so and he just looked like a prince, you know. And so we start talking, and I'm trying to make conversation with him, and he's very affable. And I said, did your dad ever, like Irish dads do, did he ever lecture you kids at the dining room table? He said, all the time, all the time. He said, at the end of the table was my brother Joe, who was killed in World War II. Then I was on the opposite, and then Bobby. Ted was way in the back, but the three boys, and he would lecture to us, and he would tell us different things. I said, well, my dad did the same thing to me. I said, that's a kind of an Irish custom. And he told me, for example, that he used to say to the three boys, I don't want any of you to be in business. He said, I've been in business. And he said, I beat them all, and I'm a success, and I got all the money I ever need, and you will never have to work the rest of your life. You can either be in public service and do something for your fellow man, or you can be a playboy and squander your money. I can't control you, but I can try to advise you. I want you to be in public service. And he used to preach like that all the time at the table. And guess what? Every single Kennedy I ever met, including the women, every one of them is in public service. You name me a Kennedy. I mean, Kennedy's sister founded the Peace Corps. I mean, they're all in public service.
You know, there were people who said old Joe was anti-Semitic. You would say
no, he told me that day, for example, he said, I don't want you boys in business because, he said, most businessmen I met are sons of bitches. That's what he said. They're sons of bitches. He said, the only businessman I ever had any good relationship with, he said, when I was in Hollywood running those studios and I was dealing with all those Jewish leaders in Hollywood, he said, they were square shooters. They gave me their word and I kept it and I got along good with those Jewish people. And then I said, well, I said to him, I said, so that business about your dad being anti-Semitic is not true. He said, absolutely not. He would criticize certain acts by certain people, but he himself was a champion of all minorities. I mean, the Irish were a minority. He was a champion. He wanted them to get ahead. He certainly wanted Jews to get ahead. He was not anti-Semitic at all. And if he was anti-Semitic, why would he raise the most liberal kids in America? I mean, he was anti-Semitic. It just wasn't true.
You know, we could go on for a long time, but I think we want to know more what you might want to ask Attorney General Kelly or the Eternal General.
Well, there's one thing I want this, the liberal audience. I want you all get mad about that United Technologies case. You say, oh, that damn United Technologies case. The Supreme Court came down and said corporations can spend money.
You mean Citizens United?
Citizens United, yeah. United Technologies, I thought it was. Anyway, this case has said they can spend unlimited money. They have status, okay? Well, guess what case they had to overrule in order to make that case? It was my case that I presented to the Supreme Court 30 years before. It was called Chamber of Commerce, which has never changed, Chamber of Commerce versus Dick Austin. And that was the ruling law for 40 years, which says corporations could be evil. Corporations should be regulated. Corporations are not individuals. Corporations shouldn't have this right. That was the ruling law for 40 years, and they overruled the whole thing. So the ruling law, the good law, came from Michigan, and it was my case. So.
If you would like to ask a question, raise your hand. Kristen will go and please say, you know who we are, so tell us who you are.
Hi, I'm Vince Caruso. Thanks for being here, the two smartest men in Michigan.
Where?
I moved to Michigan from Ohio, thinking that Michigan was a very progressive state, partially due to Frank Kelly and all his very hard efforts and most appreciative efforts. It's changed a lot, unfortunately, in my opinion. We have a very gerrymandered state now. They're trying to change that. I'd like to get your advice on that. And as an example of that, just now they're voting on whether to take away your right to farm solar and wind energy, basically to make you give up your solar and wind energy at a very low cost and have to buy it back from the utility at a very high cost. And that's partially due, I think, to the way our state government is set up. It's very unfortunate. I think counterproductive, and with meetings in Paris right now, we know that we're facing some major problems with climate change. And this is like putting the pedal to the metal as we go with a cliff in the state of Michigan. We could be energy independent with wind and solar.
Let me sort of reframe that into a manageable question. We have to be careful of those killer trees. Frank, why did Michigan go from being a progressive state to sort of a right-wing state, and what can folks do about that?
Well, it all has to do with See, my pet peeve when I started out the saying is they've got the people of Michigan, and unfortunately the whole United States, I think, convinced that the government is their enemy and the government's not that important. Therefore, if the government's your enemy and really out to take advantage of it in some way, then there's not much reason to vote, is there? And, of course, that's just the opposite of what you should be doing. You should be voting. And in other words, if the knowledgeable people voted in their true numbers, no reaction would ever get elected in Michigan. None. They would never get elected. But they don't vote. 60% of the people who would make a difference don't even vote. And they definitely don't vote in the off year. So what's happened is the Republican Party have for 20 years have a concerted effort when they win the governorship and the legislature in the off years, which they always do, that's when they take up apportionment. Then they reapportion the legislature to make sure that that their party is reelected. For example, I took the case to the Supreme Court in 1964 about one man, one vote, but that was based on numbers, not on territory. And, of course, you know, there was 77,000 people in northern Michigan had a senator, and 270,000 people in Detroit had the same. This guy up here had the same vote. So we had that switched around. So then they came up with territorial apportionment or malapportionment. And, what, for example, in Lansing or like in this area here, you should have your own congressman. It's an intellectual town, big university. Michigan State the same way. And what they do is they cut the territory like this, but then they go four counties up, they'll go up like this and pick up 75 or 80,000 Republican votes way out of your district, so you can't win. And they do that with every single congressional district they can.
What can these folks do about that?
Well, if you voted in the off year and voted them the hell out of there, took over the apportionment, you could do it. If you don't take over the apportionment, you're never going to win. And the average person doesn't even know how to spell it, much less do anything about it. And that kind of frustrates me, you know.
I guess. Next question.
Tony Derzinski, I'm an Ann Arbor resident. You know, you talked about your Irish heritage, but there was a rumor floating around the state 40, 50 years ago that you were really not Irish, that you were actually one of my people. Would you comment on your Polish heritage?
That's Tony Derzinski, a Harvard graduate and a great friend of mine, former state senator, and a great guy. But he brings us up wherever I go.
Tony, old.
Now, whatever. What happened was, when I was in Alpena, you know, it was a joke. Posen, you heard of Posen? The Posen Potato Festival, which is between Rogers City and Alpena. It's the potato capital of Michigan, supposedly. But everybody in this Posen is Polish, from Posen in Poland. They're Polish. And they had a parade every year, okay? The Posen Potato Festival. And so the first year that I'm Attorney General, and not only that, but I went to Alpena the first night I'm there, staying in a motel, I couldn't read the Protestant Bible. That was a sin. So I read the phone book, you know. So I pulled out the phone book, and I looked in the phone book for Alpena, 17 Kellys. I says, holy gosh. Well, I do well in this town, you know. There's a lot of Irish in here. I'll really clean up. Well, about 8 months later, I had every Kelly in town. The only problem was their real name was Kelishevsky. And they were all Polish from Posen, every one of them. So then, the first year I'm Attorney General, I've got to be in the Posen Potato Festival. So I get a convertible. So just as a joke, we put Frank J. Kelly, Attorney General, knee Kelishevsky as a joke. You know, just as a joke. And we're going up and down the parade. Tony and Poles from all over the Michigan are there. I never knew Kelly was Polish, so we just let it go. And that's where it started. And the sign was a nice new sign. I used it in about 8 parades, you know. I didn't want to waste it, so.
Next thing he's going to tell you is that Obama is not an Irish name.
No, but guess this. Get this. It got so bad, that Tony doesn't know it. 20 years later, I get a call from Rome, from the office of the Pope. Cardinal so-and-so wants to speak to me immediately on behalf of the Pope. I said, you do? Yes, we have one question, because the Pope was Polish then, okay? One question, Mr. Kelly. I said, okay, Eminence, what is it? Are you or are you not of Polish extraction? So the truth had to come out. But in the meantime, I can't tell you how many votes I got because of that sign.
I think it's like there's a lady right here.
Hi, I'm Sybil Colin, and thank you for, I loved your book. And I had the honor of seeing you speak in front of the DNR back in 1993. You came to our in-service, and you got a great ovation. And so I read your book, and you talked about the environment and the consumer protection that you started, and you had a chapter on the consumer protection. But the only real environmental thing you mentioned was the PBB crisis, and I really want you to write a chapter on the environment, because I've been working as a government employee for 23 years, and I really appreciate what you did for us. Thank you.
Well, okay, the environment is, when I first got elected, my dad was always believing in having, smarter, experienced old-timers around you, they had experience. And one of them was an old newspaper man. He'd been nominated 3 times for Pulitzer Prize because every time he was drunk when he voted, he never got it, But anyway, he was a smart guy. And he told me, he came up to see me, my dad was already gone, but he came up to see me, and he said, I got to give you this advice. And he said, if it's difficult to spell, the newspapers can never hurt you. If it can't be explained in one paragraph, they can't attack you. You get in all kinds of trouble with apportionment, and the public won't know what you're doing or care less, And the same thing with the environment. Now, for example, I came up with a novel idea that worked in the environment, and no newspaper ever told you about it. But it was this. Corporations love the idea of having environmental laws. Okay, it says, oh, my gosh, if you put mercury into Lake Michigan and you put so many tons in there, you're going to have to pay you might have to pay $90,000 fine. No, oh, my God, $90,000 fine. So the lawyers present know there's 2 sides of the law. There's the law side and the equity side. So we came up with a theory of going in with the equity side. So we don't want any fines from this corporation. We want the court to take over the problem of this environment and order this company to clean it up, and the court will supervise the cleanup, and they have to spend X number, whatever it takes, to clean it up. And we did that, and I got hundreds of millions of dollars worth of cleanup in the environment. But no newspaper ever did it. I was pictured Michael Moore, the guy did that nice story about Roger. Was Roger Smith?
Roger Smith.
Yeah,
yes,
Roger. Anyway, Moore's a friend of mine. And the only reason he's a friend of mine, he got elected to school board in Flint when he was 17.
Yeah.
Remember? So they said he couldn't sit. So I wrote a legal opinion. I said, if he's 18, by the time it's time to swear him in, he can sit down. So he's loved me ever since. Michael Moore. But what was I going to talk about, Michael Moore?
There's another lady right here.
Hi there. I'm Zoe Clark's mom. That's all that's really important about who I am.
It's Elisa Gottlieb, and she's a sophomore.
it's such a pleasure to be here. And Attorney General, I feel like you're a national treasure. And based on that and hearing your wonderful stories, I'd like you to speak a little bit on your opinion of our relationship with Cuba going way back to the Kennedy days and where you see it going in the future.
Cuba. What do you think about Cuba?
Well, Cuba was always Cuba was owned by the mafia years ago. It was an outpost of the mafia, and they ran Batista. He was on their payroll, and the whole place was corrupt, and it was all run by the mafia, gambling and all the different vices, and so obviously anybody that was halfway honest and righteous like Castro started out to be, would win, you know. And so they got the thing going over there, and they got rid of Batista, and they kicked the mafia out of Cuba. But it never was a starring shine of Central America, you know. It was always corrupted by gangsters and so on. I mean, that was the reputation.
What do you think about our recognizing them now?
Well, I think it's a good idea. I think it's a good idea. But you can tell what you want about Castro. Guess what? Castro, they have a better birth rate and a better health rate than we do. They have less baby deaths than we do. And one thing Castro did do, he started opening the medical school. He created thousands of doctors immediately. Immediately. And that's why Michael Moore, in one of his movies, is shown rowing into Cuba to get medical care. But, no, he did a lot of good things, as you know, socialist idealists try to do. And so I think that, you know, Cuba should be, first of all, it have to be reconstituted and get honest for a change from the ground up. And I think it is honest enough now, but we've had economic boycotts that couldn't get anybody to do anything. I mean, how'd you like to drive around in a 27-year-old Chevrolet, you know?
Some of us do, Frank.
But Cuba doesn't have many natural resources or anything, and so it became a natural entertainment spot. But it could be, you know, added to America's attractions of a tourist and recreation spot, put in an honest government, it'd be fine.
Yeah, speaking of that.
I brought many Cuban families over here, by the way. Yeah. I brought several Cuban families. If you could sponsor them in those days. So in the early days, I sponsored three or four families. I brought them over, and I gave them jobs. One guy I gave a job to, he was a CPA in Cuba. He had a Cadillac and a home on the water, a big, beautiful home. And Castro stripped him. And he came over here, and they wouldn't let him become a CPA here because he couldn't speak the language. And I put him as a chief investigator in my consumer protection division, and he made a good living for the rest of his life, but he stayed there. So I tried to help him in my own way. But Cuba's, you know, yes, the answer to the question, would Cuba be a good asset of the United States? Properly run? Heck yes.
You know, Frank, we don't deal with this in the book, but you mentioned organized crime. There was always organized crime in Michigan. Did they ever try to buy you off?
Sure.
What happened?
I was attorney general about 2 weeks. And, of course, I had a problem because I had an uncle by marriage, my mother's sister. My mother had a sister who was vivacious, which means she sang with all the big bands. And she'd been around the United States and back by the time she was 22. She'd been around, okay? And she married this guy who looked like Clark Gable, only better looking. But he was a professional gambler. So I wound up with an uncle who was a gambler, and he was in with all the gambling outfits and the mafia and so on. And he was always suffering from mixed feelings. My dad didn't want me to ever have anything to do with gambling, and he used to tell him, don't you ever tell Frankie about gambling. Tell him just the opposite. So sometimes he'd tell me, gambling is for fools and don't do it. But I'm only attorney general 2 weeks, and he didn't do this directly. But somebody knew my connection to this crazy uncle, and the guy comes into my office. Imagine right in the office, the big. I had an office in the Capitol then with 16-foot ceilings, great big office. And I just had a check for bugging a couple of days before because they bug everything. And I had ex-FBI guys in checking for bugging, and they couldn't find any bugging. So he comes out and he said, Frank, you're a nice guy. I said, you can only have this job for 4 or 5 years. How'd you like to get out of here a millionaire? I said, okay, what's coming now? And he said, well, they would set up a Swiss bank account. A Swiss bank account, and they would put whatever you want in there, $75,000 to $100,000 a year. We'll put it in. If you want more, maybe we'll get you more. And he said, you can stay here 4 or 5 years, and you'll retire, you'll be a rich man. I said, are you nuts? I said, if this room's bugged, you're going to jail for about 5 years right now. I said, you better shut up. And I said, because I know who you are, I said, you can get out of here right now, and if it's not bugged, nobody will bother you. But if it's bugged, you can expect to be arrested in a couple of days. And he got the hell out of there. But they offered it to me.
You think he'd want to give that to Michigan Radio?
Now, if you think that Michigan is a clean state, just remember this. In 1945, at the end of the war, Michigan was the arsenal of democracy, right? We were producing a plane a minute at Willow Run. We furnished more munitions and more help than any state in the Union to win World War II. We had an arsenal of democracy, okay? Well, you don't remember that there was a Ferguson grand jury in 1945, and one-man grand jury, first one in 40 years. When they got done with the arsenal of democracy, the mayor of Detroit went to jail for bribery. The majority of the common council of the city of Detroit went to jail for bribery. The sheriff of Wayne County went to jail for bribery. The deputy attorney sheriff went to jail for bribery. The head of the Detroit Police Department and 34 police officers went to jail for bribery. The prosecuting attorney, they still had Duncan McRae was the prosecuting attorney, and he was going out the door because he got summoned by the grand jury, and the secretary said to him, "Should you take your hat?" He says, "No, I'll be right back." So he hung the hat on the hat is still hanging there. 50 years later, they got the hat there with the light on it. There's a lesson. But anyway, he went over there, and he was indicted. He went to jail. In other words, everybody in Detroit was on the payroll of the mob. So anybody tell you how honest we are, you can tell them that's baloney. And most governors up until modern times were successfully intervened with, you know.
You served with 5 governors.
Yeah, they were all honest.
Who was the hardest to get along with?
The hardest to get along with was Romney. Yeah. Because he had no government experience. He was used to running American Motors, and he thought the attorney general was like a corporate attorney. Push a button to bring that attorney in here, you know. And he'd tell me what to do. I said, "George, I'm not your attorney. I'm the attorney general of the whole state. You're just one of my clients." And we... But
if I recall correctly, he didn't like that very much.
No. Oh God, he used to shout behind closed doors. Terrible. Anyway, and he would, and you know, he was a good. He was very religious, and he'd never swear. He'd never drink coffee. He'd yell and he'd use every kind of word short of swearing. By gum, Frank. I felt like saying, "Don't use that dirty language in front of me." And we had terrible times. But it's all in the book. There's a whole chapter on my arguments with Romney. And we straightened it out.
You made a treaty. You actually made a treaty.
We actually drew a treaty up, and we made it up. And he obeyed it, and he was very good.
Well, all of his wives held him to it. All of his wives held him to it. Another question.
Frank Wilhelm from Ann Arbor. Just a comment going back to the gerrymandering and apportionment. I was at a city Democratic Party meeting a few weeks ago, and an election attorney spoke. His name escapes me, but we all have to join the League of Women Voters. They are on the cusp of thinking seriously about challenging the order of the day in Michigan. They've been holding forums around the state, a couple in the Ann Arbor area. They're testing the waters. They need us to all get on board and sign up and get involved, or else we're never going to move this glacier. So that's my comment. My question, I can hardly wait for the answer. Please give us a little perspective on what we're witnessing in American politics today. Every time I think the elevator has hit the bottom floor, there's 6 more or 8 more floors to go. In terms of just the unbelievable rhetoric
it really trumps anything you thought would
happen. Exactly. Thank you, Jack. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, let's put it this way. You all have a pessimistic side, right? And what you might say in a den to your wife, you sure as hell wouldn't want to say it out on the street, would you? You wouldn't. I have a lot of worries and pessimistic thoughts about the future of America. But I don't want to make it worse by saying anything about it. We're in trouble in this country in every area. I mean, China's beating us in everything. India's beating us in everything. Our educational system is You want a pot. Can you imagine a society in which the political leaders disrespect teachers? What the hell kind of a society is that? So in everybody's life, in my book too, in everybody's life outside their mother and father, there was a teacher, man or woman, who made a big difference in your life. And for any politician to slander them is a no good person.
You know, Frank, I think a lot of people will take heart from the fact that you weren't a success the first time you went to college.
No. Though I got out of high school when I was 15. Smart son of a bitch I was. And I was out of college when I was 16. So I went down to, I don't care what your views are about anything, but I care, but I can't lose sleep over it. Put it this way. But I always respect sincere. If a person is sincere, I'll respect your view. You have a right to. If you're sincere about it, you may be dead wrong, but I'm too old to argue with you, you know? So in my lifetime, people who were extremely religious helped me and saved me. For example, I got out of high school when I was 15. I went to the University of Detroit, and I can tell you a story about U of M. Remind me before I go, that you probably never heard before. Anyway, I went to the University of Detroit, and one semester later, my report card came home, you know, 2 C's and 3 D's. You know, I could have stayed a little while longer. But my dad said, you're not doing very good here. And I quit. He didn't want me to quit, but I quit. And I said, I made a mess of that. So I quit. And a year later, I'm working down at United Shirt Stores in Detroit. Remember United Shirt? They had a big store right in downtown Detroit at Griswold. I was working there. And I wandered over on Jefferson Avenue to the old U of D. It's now the entrance to the Chrysler Expressway. But there used to be a building. It was the original U of D building, or one of the original building. And it had a bill of fare in the front with notices, you know. I'm standing out there looking at the schedule of the University of Detroit. And out the door comes a Jesuit priest, big tall guy, about 6'2". He had a collar on, but he was in shirt sleeves. And he said, young man, can I help you? And I'll never forget, it's in the book. I said, no, Father, you can't help me. I had my chance, and I blew it. He said, I'm here to give second chances. Come into my office. I went into his office. He signed me up in 10 minutes for 10 courses to start at night 2 weeks from then. And thanks to him, I started the 10 courses. I went to 7 years of college at night and got 2 degrees. And I never missed a class, thanks to him. And if he hadn't had faith in me, I'd still be standing there looking at the billboard.
You know, in case it doesn't come up, I think one of the most surprising things, this is a radio crowd, and that you were once offered a job in radio, and you thought it didn't pay enough, and you gave a struggling young kid a chance.
Oh, yeah, well, it's in my book. But my book's very, very interesting. I read it 3 times. I read it 3 times myself. I thought, who the hell wrote this? But anyway.
We're not talking about the sex parts in here.
No,
you have to buy it to get that.
Anyway, I went to school in Arizona after my flop at U of D. I got a job at Continental Motors, and I was sitting there with me working on an aluminum bench was a kid named Harvey Hunyadi, and he had been state doubles champ at the University of Michigan. He had won the doubles championship a couple years before, but he screwed up and he was out of college. So he said, what are we doing here? I said, well, I'm going to be drafted. I'm 16 or 17. He said, well, why don't we go to Arizona and go to school out there and sit in the sun? That's my wife.
It's a governor.
Hello? I want to make sure it's not important. Hello? I'm making a speech. I'll talk to you later. It's my daughter.
I hate it when Obama calls him like
my
that.
Daughter. My daughter calls me. She lives in Naples, Florida. She's a travel agent. Anyway, where was I?
You just got to Arizona with Harvey.
So then I went out to Arizona, And now you didn't know this. All radio voices, when you were a kid, no, you're too young. When I was a kid, all radio voices in New York, California, Boston, every one of them came from the Midwest, all the announcers. Not one came from New York because the Midwest had the least accent. And so all radio announcers came from the Midwest. And so, but if you interviewed to get a job, say, oh, you're from New York. Because all New Yorkers were accent-free. So I knew I could get a job at any radio station because I was accent-free. So I went into Phoenix and got a station there, and I took a test. They wanted to hire me, and they wanted to pay me a big salary, 90 cents an hour, you know. And I'd have to take a bus and all that stuff to get there, and I'd be on the air about 3 or 4 hours. I'd make about four and spend about two to get there. I said, this is not economically feasible. And so I said, thank you, but no thanks. But then I heard of another kid from Chicago who was out there for asthma, and I said, why don't you give him a call? He's got a good voice, and he might do it. I said, okay, so I gave him the name and the address, the phone number. They called him, and it was Steve Allen, who later had the Tonight Show. he was my roommate at Arizona State. And wow. Guess what, you liberals? He was a big liberal, and we were making a movie. They were making a movie at Thunderbird Field in Arizona, so they hired all his college kids. They came on a bus, and they took us to a barn, and we got in a barn, and they put on leather flying suits, jackets, you know, and goggles, and our job was to run out of the hangar and get in the plane. And then there'd be a guy in the plane, a little guy starting the plane. He'd be in the plane. We'd get in the plane, tell him we're starting. They start the plane, the propellers would roll around. We were extras, in other words. So, and they had cords around the actors and actresses, you know, and the outdoor scenes. And Jean Tierney, she was a gorgeous girl. And they had her in the first time I ever saw a slant board where an actress could lay down halfway and there wouldn't wrinkle her dress, or, you know, because it was like this. And she's laying there near the court, and Steve Allen leans over. He was a big radical then, okay? He says, comes the revolution, she'll be working for me. Now, to get to, this is actually true. 10 years later, he called me and said, I just rented Jane Tierney's house for the winter. So, but guess what? He went from being a raving liberal to becoming a right-wing sycophant. Yeah, I think it was absolutely terrible. When I ran for senator, I wrote him. He used to come to Detroit, and I'd go on the stage with him, you know, and we'd do a little act together. But over an eight-year period, he became. So when I ran for senator in 72, I wrote him a letter to ask him to help me. He writes me back a three-page letter, you know, all this agonizing crap. Why he can't help me? I'm too liberal, you know. I wrote him a letter, and it didn't take me three pages. Anyway.
Oh, well.
Anyway, so guess what? Of all people, who do you think heard about it? Gene Kelly heard about it, and he told Jimmy Durante about it. Now, I used to go two nights a week. I'd stay at the Detroit office, and I'd stay at the Sheraton Cadillac. There was a guy named Schmidt who was the manager. And I'd go down to breakfast with him, and they'd say, anybody in the house? So if somebody important was in the house, he'd take me over and introduce me to him. I met, you know, Muhammad Ali and all of them, and Cassius Clay was then. And so I met Jimmy Durante. Jimmy Durante was alone. He's playing over at Windsor. And so I sat and had breakfast with him two or three times, and he got to be friendly. He heard about it, calls me up, and says, I heard what Steve Allen did. I'm going to stop in Vegas, pick up my troop. I'm going to come to Detroit and raise you $100,000. And he did. And he wouldn't even take any money. So if there is a heaven, pray to Jimmy Durante.
The only problem was Mrs. Calabash wasn't registered in Michigan.
I think Mrs. Calabash was his wife.
Another question.
My name is Ars. I'm 84 years old. I voted for Frank lots and lots of times. My wife used to be finance director of the Michigan Democratic Party, Eileen Mars. You may have remembered her. I am as sad as Frank is about what's happened to the state, and I agree with him completely about what has to be changed about it. But I've got a grandson and a granddaughter who are growing up in Michigan, and I hope they'll see it in a different way than I'm seeing it now.
Thank you. You're right.
Frank, is it fixable? Can we take this state back?
Well, I think, you know, human, we're all human. And look, we're having a bad spell right now, right? We're not doing very well. But look at China. They're doing real well. So do human beings have the ability to do good things? Yeah, they have the ability to do good things. We just got to get our act together. And the biggest problem we've got the American people convinced that government's the enemy and the corporations are good. It's just the opposite. Corporations aren't very good, and the government is their only savior. But until we do that, we're not going to go anywhere. It's that simple. Franklin Roosevelt used the government to save us during the Depression. Name me one thing for you that happened to you or your children that came from a corporation as opposed to the government. I'd like to hear it.
Peanut butter. Next question.
Alan Stillwagon. First, my wife spent 25 years working at Ipsy State Hospital. I don't remember why, I don't remember how, but I just want you to know that you were always trusted. Somehow or other, you were always their friend.
Always what?
You were always
you're always their friend.
Trusted by the people at Ipsy State
at the
Hospital.
State Hospital. So your mental health was great.
Well, that's my dad.
I got two questions. How many people here have a strange love of Detroit? And, you know, might be unexplained. How do you think the Detroit experiment's going? You hopeful?
Well, I was a little pessimistic towards the end there. I was born and raised in Detroit. I love Detroit. It's all in my book. But one of my old guys drove me down to downtown Detroit, and I was amazed. I haven't been in downtown Detroit in a couple of years, and I saw 25 new buildings, beautiful bright lights. I found people walking the streets with impunity, just happy as a lark, and groups of people, all different types. And so I think that it'll come. I don't think it'll ever be like the third largest city in the world or anything like that. Detroit didn't go anywhere. It just moved. I mean, Detroit still exists. It's in Southfield. It's in Macomb County. It's in Oakland County. The millions of people are still here. Detroit's still here. It's just that they moved. But I think Detroit can be brought back as a real estate center and development center. And
what do you think of Duggan so far?
I don't have anything against him.
Well, do you think he's doing a good job?
Yeah, I think, you put it this way. It's a very difficult. He's doing very well with a very difficult job. Very difficult job. And he's doing the best he can. And he's somewhat limited in what he can do. And it's tough when the industry moves out on you. But the biggest problem we have in America right now is the average person doesn't make enough money. This inequality of wages is disgusting. They come over here from China and have a good time staying. My daughter's a travel agent in Florida. She can book Chinese over here in the best hotels, and they pay it and think nothing of it because their wages are 40% higher than yours. If we don't do something about that, we're not going anywhere. And who's responsible for that, the government or the corporations?
Kristen, do you have another victim there?
Right here. Hi, my name is Barbara Beaton. I'm from Ann Arbor. My brother Dan asked me to say hello to you. And I'm wondering, I work in higher education and in libraries, and I love the state of Michigan. I'm wondering if you have thoughts about how higher education and libraries can help Michigan move forward.
What's that?
What's the role of higher education and libraries in moving Michigan forward?
Well, there's two schools of education. There's the corporate mentality that believes that higher education should be used as training grounds for corporate employees, that you go to college to learn how to be a skill, to be of some help to somebody make a profit. There's other school that believes in education that you should go to college to learn to think and develop your mind and create things and be an intellectual person, And I think the first group is winning in this country. We're developing a bunch of robots, and we don't have that many scholars. And that's too bad. But I have a high regard for education. But I've talked to three or four presidents and where I have dinner at their house or something, and I tell them, and they never argue with me. I say 25% of the people in your college shouldn't even be here. They're not qualified to be here, and they're dragging down to the other 75. And unfortunately, it's true. Why? Because every mother and father thinks it's a birthright that their child should be in college. Well, it isn't. It isn't a birthright. You should have enough brains to get in. It's an advanced education. I mean, come on. You want to dumb down everything, then just give the keys to China and forget about it.
Frank, you told me, and this sort of impressed me, that we haven't really touched on this, but you didn't have a lot of money growing up. And you told me that one reason you wrote this book was because you felt you hoped some young person would read it and think that maybe they could have a life like yours.
See, that's the problem. I wrote the book for people, you know, that are starting out in life, and then I speak to people, and you're all like me. We're winding up our life, you know. But I forgot to tell you, I read a book called Country Lawyer, and that's how I happened to move to Alpena. Because this was written by a son of a guy whose the father practiced law in a Midwestern town at the turn of the last century, in 1900, 1920s. And he was a big deal. I read this idealistic book, and that's when I decided to move to Alpena. And it's idealism. And I think, for example, I met a lot of idealistic people. I sat with Archbishop Makarios in Cyprus 8 hours. You remember him? He had the big hat. He was a Greek Orthodox bishop, and he was the head of state, and he was the head of the church in Cyprus. I was supposed to have a half-hour audience with him. We spent 7 hours together, just he and I. And he was such a wonderful man. All he ever talked about during his day, how he's going to try to help humanity. And when we were all done, we were in this beautiful British palace when it had been a protectorate of the British on Cyprus, and a beautiful palace, and Cadillac drove him there in the morning. So he said, I want you to see where I live. So I got in the car with him, and we went back downtown, and we got off at the edge of town, and we walked 4 blocks, and he lived in a bedroom where he started out 50 years before. No toilet, just a wash basin and a candle, and that's where he slept every night. He says, I don't want to lose my humility. And that's the kind of, and I met lots of people like that in this world. As long as we have people like this in the world, that's what public service is all about. And there are good people out there. They just got to be encouraged, not these selfish stooges of corporations we got now.
Frank, it occurs to me that there's been 3 attorney generals since you left, and all of them, seems to me, were mainly concerned with running for governor. Is the office the same as it was in your time?
Well, I made a point. My dad always said, you know, leave it, when you leave a job, leave it up to the political writers and analysts and professors. They can critique your successors. Don't you do it, because they'll just sound like sour grapes, you know? So I don't say anything about anybody who's succeeded me, including the president of the third grade. I was president of third grade, and I've never criticized my successor.
But not apart from people. We have term limits. We've had, for example, the Consumer Protection Act that you worked on with Milliken has been gutted largely. Is the office as powerful as it was when you were there?
No. No, for example, the thing about it is, not only do people not care about government anymore, they don't know anything about it. The average lawyer, I'm talking about lawyers that went to law school, does not know what the attorney general does. They could not tell you. Okay? Now, the attorney general is the attorney for all state agencies. That means, let's say, the highway department. Every lawyer in the highway department is an assistant attorney general. In the mental health department, every lawyer in the mental health. Now, there's 133, 137 agencies, depending on how you count them. And every one of those agencies don't want the attorney general in. They don't want the Attorney General telling them what to do. They want to do what they want to do. Okay? Since I left, 133 agencies have hired their own lawyers, and they pay no attention to the Attorney General.
How did you prevent that? This has always intrigued me. How you prevented that?
Well, I used to prevent it real easy. Because I would go to each one as they were appointed. I said, if you hire one lawyer, I won't defend you in court. You can pay it yourself. And that shut him up real quick.
And you let the governors have an assistant attorney general who was on your payroll but who reported to them.
Right. Governor's own attorneys were assistant attorney general assigned to me. Because under the Constitution, the attorney general is the lawyer for the government, period. And yet, there's over 500 lawyers working for state agencies that pay no attention to anybody, and they just service the agency and tell them what they want to hear. And guess how many times the public interest is protected there?
You know, I want to take one more question, then Frank and I will be very happy to sign books. The book we did together, not other books. And if there's somebody who has some kind of a question that they haven't had a chance to ask. This young lady right here. Or maybe we can take two if...
Susie Westcott, Chelsea, Michigan. It's really an honor to be in your presence. You are indeed a national treasure. I was talking to a 33-year-old relative of mine, and she's interested in politics and the common good. And during the last election, she was with other professional, young professional, 30-somethings, and they said, well, we don't agree with either party, so we don't vote. What would you, if you could say anything to them, a young 30-something, what would you say?
There's a lot of young people today who just don't vote. They don't like either party. They say a plague on both houses. What would you say to that?
Well, that's why I wrote the book. I'm trying to get to them. I'm trying to say that, you know, it's important that you participate in public service, that you can control your own country, but you got to make an effort. It's not going to happen by itself. And we got to remember that we are Homo sapiens, and we do have certain characteristics. For example, would anybody argue with me if I said that the average human being is more interested in the Super Bowl and the championship of the Big Ten than they are their state government? Would anybody argue with me? So we're not as perfect as we'd like to think we are. We're not as rational as we think we are. 200,000 people will gather on a weekend for a sporting event, and you couldn't get 20,000 people to see Lincoln do the Gettysburg Address. You know? It's just, so the fault is ours. We're only capable of so much. I don't expect perfection from us, but I expect a hell of a lot more than we're producing.
You know, early
we ought to be at least as good as a Chinese.
On an encouraging note, in early 2014, I went to the post office to send the final manuscript with revisions via registered mail to Frank. And the post office clerk looked at it and he said, isn't he ever going to retire? Most people think you're still there. And the other thing, I want to close with this note. This was the remarkable thing is that in 37 years, there was never any charge of corruption. Now, Frank hired, he won't tell you this, he hired a few assistants who were not quite right, and they just disappeared. Nobody, like not Jimmy Hoffa style, disappeared. They just weren't working there anymore. But never was there any hint of corruption on the part of Frank Kelly. And the other thing that we haven't talked about tonight, if you read this book, it's not a legal textbook. This man had a fascinating life. His father ran the best speakeasy in Detroit. He worked on, before the Mackinac Bridge, he worked on the car ferries at a young age. I think he may have fudged his application a bit. But he just had, and his life is really a tour through almost in a century of some of the most fascinating history in this state. The only thing that I have against Frank is that he's more alert and more mentally acute at age 91 than I am at 63. But I love him, and it's been an honor to be with him tonight. And thank you all for doing us the honor by coming.